so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Hello, everybody. I'm Mark Middleton, along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder, the show that is rebranding aging and proving that you, too, can turn the rest of your life into the best of your life. Coming up in just a moment, How to Be Alive. Internationally known author Colin Bevan will share the secrets to finding true happiness.
And we're also going to meet a couple, both of whom developed a rare condition that's often misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, and this is a story you need to hear.
Plus, we've got the bodybuilding oncologist who used himself as a test subject in order to prove what we're all capable of as we age.
And one of America's top designers of clothes for the mature woman will share the secrets of her entrepreneurial success. And one of America's top dermatologists will tell us how to love the skin we're in. All of that and more right now on Growing Bolder.
He is a provocative and acclaimed author and activist who's known worldwide as the No Impact Man after gaining international attention for pretty much going off the grid and trying to live an entire year with his family in New York City with a net zero environmental impact. In fact, he wrote a book about it, and then a documentary film was made about it. Since then, he's been featured on NPR, Nightline, Good Morning America, The Colbert Report, and many other major media outlets. It seems like what he really wants to do is create a safe and healthy life that both helps other people and our planet, and at the same time is full of friends, fun, meaning, and purpose. That's it. That's all he wants to do. Fortunately, he's pretty much written a book about how to make that happen. It's called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. Let's find out more from the man himself, Colin Bevan. Colin, how are you today?
Good, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, you know, thanks for all you do, because you make us think about trying to create a better life. And I know this book was written for people of all ages, but, you know, Colin, there is no question that as we get older, more of us are searching for our purpose, looking for fulfillment, trying to figure out how we can make a difference. This seems to be pretty much a win-win for you, because it does appear as though you're finding your purpose and helping others find theirs. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, I think that's what happened with No Impact Man, which was my previous book, where I lived as environmentally as possible for a year, is that by kind of letting go of all the stuff, that is to say, you know, stuff that we chase after to buy and stature and status and all that kind of stuff, and actually ending up living according to my values, I got this beginning of a connection to an idea of what a better life could be. And in the meantime, I met literally thousands of people I called life questers, who are people questing after a way of life that's better for them and better for the world. And so that's what How to Be Alive is about. And yes, I feel so purposeful and privileged that I get to be part of this conversation.
You know, I love the whole life quester thing. And of course, we've all heard the saying, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. Are life questers, do they enjoy the life? Do they enjoy the quest even before they achieve what they're going for?
So the research shows that when we strive to live according to our values, that is to say that when we are actually just in the very action and effort of living in line with who we are and in a way that helps ourselves, our communities, and our wider world, that just the attempt to do that, the science shows, actually makes us happier. So yes, you know, because if you think about it, so many of us have actually become alienated from ourselves. We're following directions. You know, we went to college. We're paying off our student debt. Now we're in the corporation. We're working in a job. 80% of Americans don't like their jobs. We're working in a job we don't like. We're just trying to make ends meet. We feel as though we've lost ourselves. And so a lot of what How to Be Alive is about is actually trying to reconnect to who you are in a way that helps the world, and that just that very connection, just that very attempt, actually makes people happier.
The reward is in the effort, is absolutely true. And you know, it's so. How do we know who we are? Because we all have been, you know, brainwashed to some degree by the culture in general, by the media, by our families, by our friends, by our jobs. And I think it's pretty easy if you kind of always know who you want to be, but you were just afraid to go after that. But many of us just don't even have a clue anymore. How do we get in touch with who we are?
That's right. So that's the hard bit that so many of us, when you say, well, what do you want to be? We don't know. And how to tell? We're bad predictors of what will make us happy in the future. Human beings can't tell what will make us happy sometime a distance from now. What we can tell is what made us happy and what's made us fulfilled and what's made us feel as though we were helpful and purposeful in the past. So one big trick is just to look back and ask two things. The first is, where in my past have I disappeared to myself when I've been doing something? Like for some people, it may be at a computer writing. For some people, it will be on a surfboard. For some people, it would be planting a tree and in nature. Where have I disappeared to myself? Where have whatever I've been doing been so in line with who I was that I kind of disappeared? That's the first question. So make a list of all those times. And then the next question is, what have I cared about in the world? What has moved me when I've heard about it, a problem in the world, in the community, with other people that I know? What has moved me so much that I've been actually willing to make an effort without even trying? And then make a list of those two things. And then the question becomes, okay, how can I manifest that? How can I manifest those things in my life? And for many of us, starting by changing our careers is too big. So how can we do it in some of our small, how can we do it in our current job? So for example, for some of us, we're really concerned about race. So how could I talk my employer into making sure that our hiring policy is actually fair and just and reaches all communities? Or some people care about how they eat. So how can I bring my values in how I eat and actually begin to have meals together with other people? In other words, don't start with a gigantic thing, our career, which is really hard to change, but bring our passions and our concerns into our daily interactions and let that grow into potentially later a change in career.
We got to figure out a way to turn the autopilot off that guides so many of our lives. Folks, we're talking with Colin Beavan, who's the author of How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. Colin, how much of being happy is simply just learning to pause and be present and to be grateful, or does that only get you so far?
Well, you know, there's three things. Three psychological needs that a group of people called self-determination theorists say that we have. And if we fulfill these needs, then we'll be so-called happy. And again, I think we have to be careful of the word happy, because I don't think happy is the goal of life. But we'll put that aside for a minute. The three needs that we have are, one, to feel autonomous. Now, autonomous means to feel that our actions are coming from within ourselves and authentic to ourselves, that we're not compelled to act the way that we act. So we're acting from ourselves, in other words. The second is to feel competent, which means that our actions make a difference, that actually I'm able to make things happen by doing things. That's the need for feeling competent. And the third is the need to feel related. That is to say that I'm in community with a group of other people and that my autonomy, my being myself, and my competence actually help that group of people. So happiness is, so yes, it's important that we pause and savor the moment and all of that type of stuff. All of that increases our happiness. But also living this kind of, this autonomous, fulfilling the needs for autonomy, competence, and relatedness, which really means becoming yourself to help the world and helping the world to become yourself. That, to me, at least in my definition, is the key to happiness.
You make a great point in the book, Colin, that once you have an idea about who you are or maybe who you want to be, it's important to find those kind of people and start hanging out with them.
That's right. It's because it's really hard. So you kind of know that you want to live according to a certain set of values. There's a woman in my book whose story I talk about. Her name is Sasha, and she just decided that she really cared about animals and also the effect that animal agriculture had on our habitat, and she wanted to become a vegan. But she came from a family where ideas like vegan and vegetarianism felt foreign, and also that she was living according to her values, it felt like an affront and a challenge to her family. So she just found like a group of people who were already involved in veganism and vegetarianism, and she learned from them and was supported to live in their values by them. And then paradoxically, when she finally had the confidence to live the way that she wanted to in the presence of her family, who kind of disagreed with her choices, it actually gave her family members freedom to begin to live according to their own values too, which is really interesting. So we venture to find people who share our values, and that gives us the strength to actually teach the people who we want to know about our values also.
You know, it's fascinating stuff, and obviously it's all about trying to learn how to live the best life we can. But let's take it up to the final minutes of our life, Colin, because you write that the ultimate benefit of learning how to be ourselves is to reduce the number of regrets that we experience on our deathbed. What are those most common regrets?
So there's an old cartoon from the New Yorker magazine that I like, and it's a picture of an old elderly man clearly on his deathbed with all the machines and the tubes coming out of him, and his wife is leaning over to hear his last words. And what he says is, "I only wish I would have bought more stuff." and we laugh at that cartoon because it tells us because we know that's exactly not true. And I would venture to say we also laugh because we're a little bit nervous that our lives are oriented towards buying more stuff when we know it makes us nervous, too. The way to live a life that, I want to be careful. Like, I'm not saying that I know anything, everything, but it does seem to be commonly true that the fulfilling life comes if we just live in this orientation, just these four words, not just for me. If I live my life not just for me, chances are, that is, it's not to say that I can't have anything that I want. It doesn't say not for me, but not just for me. In other words, if I live a way where I use what I get, who I am, and my happiness to help those around me and to engage in the wider social issues, chances are I'm going to have fewer regrets than if I'm materialist. Than if I'm a materialist that's just chasing after this stuff all the time.
Well, when you get right down to it, folks, there is not a more important conversation you can have with yourself and those around you. And fortunately, there are guys like Colin Beavan who is out there facilitating that conversation. His latest book, it is so much more than a self-help book. It's about lifestyle redesign. It's called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. Check it out. Colin, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for your time. Coming up, they feared the worst. Fortunately, their doctor wasn't fooled. The story of a husband and wife, their rare condition, and unique treatment that gave them back their lives. That's next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
If you or a loved one are over 65 and need a ride, check out Uber. Many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats like groceries and over-the-counter medication. Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584. Well, one of the facts of life, folks, if you live long enough, you will encounter health challenges. If you're fortunate, you'll receive great medical care, and if you're determined, you will bounce back. It's all about surviving and then thriving. Barbara and Judson Stryker were both put to the test.
Yeah, theirs was a rare neurological condition that is often tragically misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. But fortunately, Barbara Stryker's doctors were not fooled. They were stunned but not fooled again when Judson contracted the same thing, her husband, an extremely rare coincidence that could have ended tragically for both.
After 54 years of marriage, it's the simple things in life, like walking across campus hand in hand, that bring the most pleasure to Judson Stryker, an accounting professor at Stetson University, and his wife Barbara. In 2002, they wondered if this would ever be possible again.
Barb started showing some symptoms of having difficulty walking, She was confused in her thought process, and we had issues with shuffling.
A CT scan revealed a brain tumor, and after doctors at Florida Hospital successfully removed it, Barb's symptoms disappeared.
She recovered from this, and then everything went well for about 10 years. And after the 10 years, she began showing symptoms again.
But this time, it was much worse and far more frightening.
When I was go to bed, sometimes I'd have headaches, and I would it would sound like water was swishing in my ears.
She was close to not being able to function at all.
Some of her symptoms were similar to Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and the Strikers feared the worst, until a multidisciplinary team of specialists at Florida Hospital accurately diagnosed a rare and progressive condition called normal pressure hydrocephalus, or NPH, in which cerebral spinal fluid can't drain properly, causing pressure on the brain.
Even in the general practitioners are not fully aware of it and do not spot it or misdiagnose it.
While there is no cure for hydrocephalus, her doctors recommended a procedure that can dramatically relieve symptoms, implanting a shunt to redirect the excess fluid.
Essentially, you implant it into the brain, you wear it on top of your head, a tube runs down your back and into your abdomen, and it releases those fluids and balances it out.
And where that, it's absorbed then.
Where it's absorbed, correct.
Barbara had the shunt implanted in 2012, and her symptoms began to disappear quickly. Within a month, she remembered how to play the piano, one of her greatest joys.
Just a remarkable, almost unbelievable change in the way she behaved both physically and mentally.
Amazingly, check. 1 year later, okay. Judson began experiencing similar symptoms, rapid cognitive decline, and more.
And I kept having a great deal of difficulty walking and balance and pain up into the back.
A distinguished and highly honored professor, Judson feared that his career as an educator was over when tests revealed that he too had NPH. But in another successful surgery, doctors at Florida Hospital implanted a shunt in his brain, and like Barbara, his symptoms were dramatically diminished, allowing him to return to the career that he loves.
It is very rewarding to see by this process we can select those patients with suspected normal pressure hydrocephalus and then at least intervene in that process and give them their life back.
Judson is back in the classroom, and Barbara is back at the keyboard, and both are back in the lives of those who need and love them the most.
The extra time, it's been a huge blessing to be able to have them in my children's life and in my life longer, and we know it could have gone the other way.
Doctors don't know why both of the Strikers developed hydrocephalus. It may be just a rare coincidence. Whatever the cause, the effect is that the Strikers feel obligated to spread the word about NPH, a frightening condition that is often misdiagnosed.
My personal feeling is that we're here for a purpose, and that where we can touch lives and make a difference, that's what we should be doing.
I think it was a miracle that we just found Florida Hospital. I can't even begin to tell you how kind and helpful and caring they were. From the nurses, doctors, people that would just come in and help you with anything. They were wonderful.
Over 54 years of marriage, two children, and three grandchildren, the Strikers have shared all of life's ups and downs, including a rare neurological condition. And thanks to great medical care, they plan on sharing many more years together.
We have been more appreciative of each day we have.
You just appreciate and thank God every day for the blessings to wake up and enjoy your life.
What an amazing couple. Both are very low-key, reserved, private people, but they were actually anxious to share their story. In fact, they felt called to share their story to encourage anyone who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's to ask their doctor about NPH, normal pressure hydrocephalus.
Wow, what an eye-opening story, Mark. And as we've seen so many times, hope is the most powerful medicine of all, and that's what the Strikers are anxious to give to others.
Coming up, a highly respected cancer doctor who took up weightlifting in his 50s because he wanted to prove something life-changing and maybe even life-saving to us all. This is Growing Bolder. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. And our next guest is a respected medical doctor, a cancer specialist, a speaker, author, health and fitness guru, especially to those of us over the age of 50.
Yeah, this is one cool guy. Inspired by his own unhealthy habits and his sick patients, he began lifting weights after the age of 50. He's now in his 70s, and he's an active world-class bodybuilder who recently took second place in the Masters National Bodybuilding Championship. More importantly than that, though, as Bill mentioned, he is an expert on the many benefits of fitness for older adults. Let's welcome Dr. Robert Drapkin. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Man, we love guys like you that are into physical fitness but are coming at it from an academic background. Take us back to when you actually got started with weights. What was your primary motivation back then, and were you surprised by how you responded?
Absolutely surprised. When I was about 48, actually, I took a vacation with my wife and children, and we took photographs of each other. When the photographs returned, I was surprised to see how I looked. And that was the immediate stimulus to change some of my lifestyle. I joined a gym and thought, since I was a physician, that I could exercise and improve. And after 2 years, I found objectively that I had not changed at all. And was fortunate enough to meet an expert in body mechanics, diets, and exercise, a personal trainer, who he and I became good friends. And with his help, I've learned more about diet, exercise, and nutrition than I ever learned in medical school, and I was able to make improvements.
Well, that's incredible.
That was a big surprise.
What didn't you know? Or because I assume when you started, you're just like most of us who join a gym. What were you missing, and what made the difference?
Well, one of the big differences was in actually understanding how your body works, what types of food are healthy to eat, and what types of food is not healthy. You know, most of us eat what we saw our parents eat, what our families eat, and we get marketed heavily by television and the media to eat certain foods. You have to understand that some foods are healthy, some foods are not healthy. I was surprised to learn that it's important to have a high protein diet and to exercise to the point where you actually exert yourself. Those are the two main ingredients for success in any exercise program. Your body will adapt to any changes that you make within reason, and as your body adapts, you improve. As you get older, people tend to, if they don't exercise, they'll lose approximately 1% of their muscle mass each year, starting in your 30s. By the age of 50, you could have lost 20% of your muscle mass. When you lose muscle, you actually get weaker and less active. When you get weaker and less active, you tend to gain weight, gain body fat. And that's what happens to most people as they get older. It's not guaranteed to happen, but it does happen to, say, the majority of us as we, you know, don't exercise and eat what we're accustomed to eating. And once you learn that protein is good, high glycemic carbohydrates are bad, and that you exercise at least 3 times a week and exert yourself to some degree, you can see some improvements. So that's really a summary, and the summary of what I've learned in the last 20 years.
You know, I want to tie two of those things together if I can, because you mentioned vigorous exercise, and you know, people talk a lot about walking being good for you, and it certainly is, and we encourage anybody to get out there and walk, but we are now learning that vigorous exercise, you know, really brings with it its own reward. And speaking of vigorous exercise, weightlifting is something that was never recommended for older people until recently, and now guys like you are actually saying people can start lifting weights in their 80s and 90s, correct?
That's absolutely correct, and I believe it's essential because your body will adapt. You can build muscle at any age. And when you build muscle, you're actually stronger, more active, and you feel better. And that's, I think, a quality of life is extremely important. Frailty is not guaranteed to happen if you exercise properly. And the CDC has excellent recommendations. They say you have to do some cardiovascular exercise, and that the intensity may be a real important factor here. But the CDC also says you need to exercise your muscles at least twice a week. I recommend exercising each muscle group once a week and do it over 3 separate days. And that way you cover each muscle group, you won't lose muscle, and you'll be stronger and more active and healthier.
And Dr. Drapkin, have you found a connection at all between fitness and things like Alzheimer's or dementia?
Absolutely. One of the first things you notice in the elderly is a poor memory. Actually, in people who don't exercise, you'll know that their hippocampus actually shrinks. That's the part of the brain where your memory is. If you exercise, you can actually show increasing hippocampus size in people who exercise, associated with improvement in memory. So that's one of the first benefits of exercising is improvement in your memory. But every organ in your body actually will show improvement if you exercise and eat a healthy diet.
We're talking with a highly respected cancer specialist, and Doc, we're always pleased to learn about guys like you because most doctors are anxious to prescribe medication before lifestyle modification. Are we over-prescribed? Do prescription meds contribute to the decline in our overall health?
Well, this is probably the most important topic in medicine today, is what happens when you go to your family doctor and he says, Bob, your blood pressure is a little high, and maybe your sugar is a little high. And don't worry about this. This happens as you get older. Here, take these pills. You spend maybe 12 minutes with your primary care doctor, and he never discusses. Well, he may say you were exercising and maybe change your diet, but really doesn't get into the specifics. These things, you know, type 2 diabetes has become basically an epidemic in this country, and it's affecting younger people every day. These high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, are, in my opinion, are completely curable and preventable with proper diet and exercise. And it's not something that's, you know, well, if I can do it, anybody can do it. But it's not something that you can discuss in 5 minutes or 12 minutes. It takes a lot of time, a lot of patience, and frequent visits in order to make sure your patients are eating healthy and exercising properly. And you can actually cure type 2 diabetes with diet and exercise.
Doc, we're going to have to get you back because there is so much more to talk about. He is Dr. Robert Drapkin, one of the good guys who not only prescribes lifestyle modification before medication, he takes the prescription himself as a nationally world-ranked competitive bodybuilder. Thanks, Doc. Coming up, if you watch QVC, you will most definitely know our next guest, who is one of the world's top fashion designers and retailers, what she's learned about building a thriving business, next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder.
I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and you're listening to Growing Bolder. Folks, do you watch QVC? Did you know that QVC broadcasts live in the United States 24/7 and ranks as the number two television network in terms of revenue, with a net revenue of over $8 billion?
It is a monster, and that's just in the U.S., Bill. QVC has been transformed into one of the world's leading e-commerce and mobile commerce retailers. Their programming is now distributed to over 350 million homes worldwide. And our next guest recently celebrated her 25th year on the air with QVC as its in-house fashion designer, where she has built one of the world's top fashion brands. Let's find out more as we welcome Susan Graver. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hi. Good to meet you, Mark and Bill.
You know, great. I don't know if you're one of the smartest women we've ever talked to or one of the luckiest, because talk about jumping in at the right time. I'm sure it seemed like a huge risk, but you were already successful in major department stores and catalogs. This is the mid-90s. Yep. TV retailing just getting started, but somehow a Susan Graver denim skirt and a vest found its way to QVC, and the rest is history. How did you find QVC, or how did they find you?
They found me, to be honest with you. I was in every major department store, and Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Nordstrom's, all of the stores. QVC literally walked into my showroom. I never heard of them. I had no idea who they were. And they tested, you know, a few items, and it did very well, and they kept reordering. And they actually came into my showroom, and they bought a major program of all these wonderful poly silk fabrics, the whole collection, and invited me to go on air. And literally, I had nothing, you know, I had no idea where QVC was. I kind of ventured to Westchester, Pennsylvania, thinking that I was going to go on air for maybe 5 minutes. Introduce myself and walk off. And to be honest, I was thrown on air for an hour straight and had to talk about my product for an hour, totally unrehearsed, and basically just spoke about my designs and what I had been doing in the showroom for many years for every major department store. And very nerve-wracking. I was never behind a camera before. And it was one of the number one hours. It made QVC history. It's in their financial records. And I guess it was very exciting. And I guess that was the beginning. And QVC kept bringing back reorders and testing it and putting me on and testing it with me on and with me off. And eventually asked me to become exclusive to QVC and no longer design for the major department stores. And I basically took a leap of faith because it was a great success. I loved going on air. It was amazing having this immediate connection with viewers that were watching and can give me feedback. And it was really a phenomena. It was going on 26 years now, and I've had a weekly show for close to 26 years, every Thursday at 9 a.m. Past few years, I now have two, we call them static hours. I'm on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. and then Sunday evening at 10 p.m. And designed exclusively for QVC, and we are now gone global. I've been in the UK for the past maybe 15 years, and we're opening up Germany right now. We're currently working on that. And it's been the best experience. I love going on air. I love the connection I've made with all my customers. And now we have the whole social media edition where we can constantly every day speak to customers. And we've really grown the brand, and we just keep pushing forward, keep, you know, building the brand and moving it forward and keeping on top of fashion. And it's been quite quite exciting.
And that's the business. But what about Susan Graver, the woman? I mean, you built this whole thing while you were raising a family. You've inspired a whole other generation of entrepreneurs to see what's possible, you know, by taking risks and having a little courage. What is it about you, Susan, that you were able to pull all this together and have the courage to take difficult steps?
Yes, I kind of took a lot of risks, always thinking, well, I could always go back. You know, it's always like this is, you know, as long as my family's always number one, and as long as we're all healthy and being taken care of and, you know, do the best we can and see where it takes. It's basically, you know, again, you know, not knowing what the next moment's going to bring, to be honest with you. When I was with all the, before QVC came, walked in the door, I was ready to throw in the towels. I was ready to give it up. Having three kids, I was having trouble, you know, having help at home. My husband is an attorney. He was in his, you know, beginning of when I first, he was in law school when we first got married, and he was in the beginning stages of his career as well. And it was getting a little hectic for me. So I was ready to give it up. He was very supportive and has been supportive of me forever. I couldn't do it without him, certainly, and my whole family. And I think those support systems helped me do what I loved. I mean, I was very passionate about the whole designing aspect, but also the connection I make with people going on air and even in the showroom, you know, working with buyers. So for me, I was ready to give it up. And when I kind of, like, to be honest with you, got to this point in where I was like, I'm done. You know, I don't have to worry anymore about the deliveries to the department stores and cancellations and fabrics not coming in on time and designing a new collection and doing a separate collection for one store versus another store. And I was like, I'm done. My kids need me. I'm giving it all up. And I kind of had a really relaxed feeling, and my whole attitude kind of changed going into the showroom every day and designing. And just when I was ready to give it up was when QVC literally walked in my door, and they saw my collection and invited, you know, me to go on air not long after that. And so it's kind of like, I mean, I think it's kind of nice for other people to realize that too, is that, you know, things happen when you don't expect them to happen. When you know, when you are not pushing and driving and you know, trying to make things happen, things just turn around. And it was quite, you know, it's quite eye opening, and something I like to share with other people as well, that it just kind of happened.
We like to think of that, Susan, as a growing bolder story, because sometimes when you take a chance, it'll change your life, and it certainly has you. We'd love to get you back on. Susan Graver, folks, has built not only a brand, but a brand that has her name all over it. It will be exciting to see what she does in the years ahead. We've been talking with one of the top fashion designers around, the head of the QVC in-house design department, Ms. Susan Graver. Coming up, our love-hate relationship with the sun. We'll chat about the growing concerns of skin damage and worse with a top dermatologist. That's next on Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
With 70 million Americans turning 65 every single day, dermatology is a booming industry. The research side, the healthcare side, the surgical side, even the cosmetic side, skincare, has never been more important, which is why we wanted to speak with Dr. David Weinstein.
Yeah, he's the real deal, a board-certified physician in dermatology. He's done extensive research and has been published in the areas of wound healing, skin cancer, and dermatologic surgery. Let's welcome Dr. David Weinstein. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. A timely conversation. It seems as though there is a large and rapidly growing demand for dermatologists, and not just for cosmetic reasons. What areas of dermatology do you specialize in, and how much of what you are seeing do you think is age-related?
A lot. I'd say a significant portion is age-related. A lot of what I see and focus on, some people say procedural dermatology, but that usually just means taking care of skin cancer, cutting out skin cancer, then other related procedures like involving lasers and injectable type things that might be considered cosmetic.
You know, Doc, we're more aware of skin cancer these days than ever. And you're trained in a certain kind of surgery to treat skin cancer. Can you tell us about that and what it is?
Yes, it's called Mohs surgery. And it was developed by Frederick Mohs up in Wisconsin back in the 1930s. And it's a different way of looking at skin cancer or taking out the skin cancer. So traditionally, when we cut something out, we maybe take out an ellipse, if you will, or an oval, and then we kind of bread loaf it, for lack of a better term, in terms of the way that we cut the piece of skin so that we can look at it and make sure we got it all. With Mohs surgery, we kind of take out a disc and then kind of flatten out for, if you can imagine, maybe like taking an orange, if cutting in half and then squishing it flat. And then we look at the bottom of it, because that's really what we care about. That's what we say, the true margin, or the area where if you're going to have skin cancer still on somebody, we look at all that area, whereas you're only going to get a cross-section every so many millimeters or so when you cut it the other way.
So for better or for worse, Doc, patients are becoming more educated, or maybe wrongly educated, because we're reading everything online now. Now, if someone has skin cancer, should they ask their doctor about Mohs surgery, or is that something the doctor would know? Are all skin cancers an appropriate, is Mohs an appropriate type of intervention for all types of skin cancer?
That's a great question. So Mohs isn't appropriate for all skin cancers, but definitely something a patient should ask about if they do have a skin cancer. So the areas where Mohs is really important for is where you don't have a lot of excess skin, or it's kind of areas that we say prime real estate. So your face, the head and neck region, and the hands and feet, and genitalia, those are the areas where we try to do Mohs surgery because it's tissue sparing. We end up not having to take as much or take pretty much just only where the skin cancer is, and we're sure that it's all out when at the end of the procedure before we close up the hole that we made by taking out the skin cancer.
And Dr. Weinstein, I know that your goal is that none of us ever have to come see you, at least not for skin cancer. Let's talk about prevention. What can we do to ensure ourselves or increase our chances of good skin health?
So I'd say sunblock. That's one of the most important things, and especially here in Florida, it's exceptionally important. And people used to maybe poo-poo sunblock, but we do have a great amount of information out showing that sunblock decreases not only your run-of-the-mill skin cancer, but also melanoma, and it also helps prevent aging. So that's something I'll tell my patients or try to appeal maybe to their vanity, that they've shown that people who use sunblock actually prevents the development of wrinkles, and it also prevents the development of dark spots. So people, when they compare people who have used sunblock and those who haven't over, say, a five-year period, the people who use sunblock, they say, look younger than those who have not used it on a regular basis.
We're speaking with Dr. David Weinstein. And, Doc, what about those of us who spent a lot of time in the sun unprotected as kids decades ago? Are we doomed to have skin problems as we age, or is it possible to reverse the signs of sun damage?
I wouldn't say you're doomed, and it's never too late. I guess you can maybe think of it analogous to smoking. It's never too late to quit smoking. It's never too late to start protecting yourself from the sun. The deleterious effects of sun are cumulative. So you can still start having bad side effects if you continue to expose yourself to the sun by not wearing sunblock and going out at peak hours. So using sunblock now can prevent further things down the road. That being said, if you do have some base amount of damage from when you were younger, you might get a skin cancer or two down the road. But I try to tell people, don't be dissuaded by that. Don't be disheartened. By using the sunblock, you're decreasing the amount of skin cancer that you would have gotten otherwise.
Well, you got our attention when you mentioned sunblock and less wrinkles. Are there other anti-aging or wrinkle creams out there? Maybe not naming brands, but what ingredients can we watch for that have been the most effective in helping our skin stay healthy?
So in addition to the normal, say, sunscreens that are in your usual creams, they are starting to add other things that they're finding help in terms of preventing sun damage and the wrinkles that go along with it. So antioxidants is an important thing. Some of the newer, maybe more expensive creams on the market, that sometimes they put this into sunscreens as well. They have DNA repair enzymes. One of the ways that sun damages your skin is by damaging the DNA in your skin. And so these enzymes actually kind of help repair that. Other things as well, in addition to helping repair your skin and helping to keep it youthful, is using a retinoid or retinol type cream. And that's been shown to help keep skin youthful appearing and to help prevent wrinkles as well.
Doc, in our final 40 seconds here, you know, we all want to get as much as we can get done to our skin, but of course it costs money. Where is the line drawn now between cosmetic treatment and medical treatments? In other words, what procedures are covered by insurance and which are not?
It's a tough question. It varies a little bit from insurance to insurance. So usually if something bothers a patient, meaning it causes them pain or irritation, then the insurance will usually cover that. And there are certain types of birthmarks and discoloration that insurance will cover. So they'll cover things, conditions like vitiligo, which is like bleaching of the skin or whitening of the skin, like maybe Michael Jackson had. But other types of treatments, so like sunspots or wrinklings, they typically do not cover those types of treatments.
Dr. David Weinstein, great conversation. Tip of the iceberg, folks. There is so much more to learn on this. We will hopefully have him back again, helping us all stay as healthy as we can be.
And before we go today, we want to share one recent study with you. At the National Senior Games, 4,200 competitors took part in a detailed fitness survey about their health and lifestyle. The study revealed that the fitness age of the senior competitors, based on a number of relevant factors, averaged 43 years, even though they had an average chronological age of 68. Their fitness age was 25 years younger than their real age. And what's most encouraging is that fitness age is actually a better predictor of how much time we have left than chronological age. Exercise does have a dramatic impact not only on how long we live, but more importantly, how well we live. So get out there and start growing bolder. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, going high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half right prejudice leap for ripped out. Lies that life is black and white.
sisters played by